Welcome to the Live Up podcast, where we watch the movies from our youth to see if they live up. We will review, discuss, and score the movie in question to see if it lives up to us as adults and whether it would live up to the intended audience, kids today. But today, for our 30th episode, yay us, it is time for another Live Up After Dark.
So Live Up After Dark. These are all the movies we definitely didn't see in the theater. They are slasher films that kept us lying awake in bed for months after we watched them, and killer space clown movies where they murder people of cotton candy, or Christian Slater
what a way to go.
Taking an orgasm. We knew we were not supposed to be watching these movies, but nobody came in to see what we were doing. So it's another episode of Live Up After Dark.
I feel like I need theme music for this. Like, we'll have to come up with something.
If we, like, could do a montage of all sorts of weird screaming and, like...
Oh, that's a good idea. We will have theme music. You might be hearing it right now. I don't know. I'm going to add it. Put it on my to-do list. My podcast to-do list. So for Live Up After Dark, it's pretty much the same as all of our other episodes, except when we consider the kids rating. So typically when we consider the kids rating, we consider kids today, whether they'll stumble upon it. So we're sort of going to imagine maybe a kid today accidentally watching it or sneaking it in the same way that we did. We have to give it some extra little consideration, like we did for Silence of the Lambs, obviously, because you're not showing that to your kid. Anyway, so that's the only difference for these. I'm Jess Latiman.
And I'm Amanda Treat. Today's After Dark film is a special birthday request from me.
Happy birthday, Amanda.
Thank you.
Best gift I ever gave you.
Yes, it is. This is the most epically 80s movie I can think of. It has mullets. It has boys riding around the neighborhood on bikes. Mm-hmm. It has two guys named Corey. It's got scenes set in a video rental store. It's got Kiefer Sutherland as the bully. And it's got a sexy sax guy. And it's got vampires. This is 1987, The Lost Boys.
The Lost Boys.
Woo-hoo! I'm excited. This is my birthday request, and Jess is being dragged through all the vampire mania for this.
Yes. Yeah, it is very 80s.
Oh, my God. I'm here for that. But, Jess, I don't actually know. Have you seen this movie before I made you watch it for this episode?
Funny you should ask. I actually still don't know whether I've seen this before. So I was pretty sure going into it that I'd seen this once and Flatliners once, and I kind of get them confused. Flatliners also stars Kiefer Sutherland, and I'm pretty sure I have seen them each once, but maybe this one just in pieces. And it's possible upon this viewing as an adult was probably the first time I saw it all the way through. And I will say, listeners, if you're not you know, well-versed in our catalog of now 30 episodes, when one of us has a nostalgia for a certain film and one of us is seeing it for the first time, they don't typically fare that well on this podcast. It seems you need a little bit of nostalgia, but we'll see if this one bucks the trend. I did watch this with myself, not with my kids, although I feel like I could have, even though it's technically an After Dark.
Your older daughter, but maybe not your son.
Yeah, not me. The 7-year-old, maybe the 12-year-old, but... Yeah. Now that I've seen it, I think for the first time all the way through as an adult, I kind of see why I didn't seek it out as a, I don't know, little lesbian in the 90s. There's just not that much there for me.
You weren't into all those Corys? You didn't love the Corys?
I mean, I don't dislike the Corys, but I'm not sure I would have sought out the Corys. So, yeah.
Total sidetrack, though, with this viewing. Was your gaydar going off big time?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, so yes, this is a feature where we talk about my gaydar and how sharp it is on this podcast, but it definitely was like ring-a-dinging. I saw that you had noted that in the notes, so we're going to talk about that.
Oh, hell yes.
Since this is your birthday present on this podcast and insisted on watching this, I assume you've seen it before and you're going to tell me about it right now.
Yes, all right, so... I definitely have a lot of nostalgia for this film. At least three touch points on this. The first one is when I was in junior high school in Newton, Massachusetts, I had this English teacher named Mr. Yassi, who pronounced it Mr. Yassi, because he had the most Fantastic so New England accent. Oh my God. I don't even know where he was from. It had to be like Maine or something, but everything he said went up at the end. Mr. Yossi, gonna watch The Lost Boys.
Yeah. Oh my God. I feel like you're making it up.
No, he was such a character. He was great. So that school did English and history classes as electives, almost like you pick them in college, which was super cool. And Mr. Yossi taught Dracula.
Oh.
So we read Dracula. We did an entire semester of vampire. We got to write our own, like, shitty junior high school horror fiction. And that was, super awesome. Yeah. And then we watched movies in class, including Salem's Lot, which is a lot scarier than this movie. We were all, like,
Get
you know, 12, 13 years old. We watched Salem's Lot in school.
Oh, my God. These days, you'd have, like, 12 permission forms and a protest.
Oh, my God, yeah. I'm pretty sure that's where I first saw this movie, was in the Dracula class that Mr. Yossi was teaching.
Mr. Yossi, man, I think you would have potentially gotten fired these days if you tried to
He was like the beloved English teacher, and like everybody was fighting to get into that class.
Of
it
course.
Was such a cool class.
Oh my God. So I can't imagine.
We got to see all the mullets and all the like trench coats. It was badass.
Yeah.
Junior high English. So, cut to us in college. The year before we were roommates, I had my suite. We all had singles, and I'm specifying that for a reason because I was living with all guys that year. But Deion Silver was one of my suite mates junior year of Haverford College. And he orchestrated this night where he, me, and Katie DeChocho slept out on a sidewalk overnight to get PlayStation 2s.
What?
He was just like, PlayStation 2s are getting released. It's going to be a big deal. There's not enough of them. We're going to go. So we went at midnight and like sat outside. I want to say it was like,
where were you?
A computer store or something in a strip mall. It was some place nobody thought, go get the PlayStation 2s. And we camped out overnight, and there was, like, a little line, but we were the first three people. And then, like, the manager came at, like, 4 a.m. and was like, all right, we have 8 of these, and, like, we're giving each of you a number.
Yeah.
And everyone else who shows up can wait, but, like, you're the top 8. And we went in, got those things, and, like, ran back to his car because we thought we were going to get, like, mugged for the PlayStation 2s.
Oh,
and then
God.
Went to class, and were delirious because we'd been awake all night. On a cold November sidewalk. Like, it was crazy. Anyway,
I did not
my awesome
this.
Suite mate, Dan Silver, the first thing he did with the PlayStation 2 was run out and get a Lost Boys DVD. And we sat and we watched the Lost Boys. And we did have some PlayStation 2 games and, like, some awesome tournaments going
What's,
on in
What
that
PlayStation
suite,
are they up to now? Do they even make them anymore? Is it PlayStation,
I don't know.
Like, 50?
We were assuming they would be at least caught up to the Fast and the Furious movies, but they are not. We are not on PlayStation X at this
We're
point.
Not. We're not.
No. I'm not nerdy enough to know what we're up to. I want to say 4, but I'm probably totally wrong. Please don't send hate mail, but
yeah.
I did sleep outside for a PlayStation 2.
I mean, I feel like this makes you like legit, I think, at this point. And then the first thing you guys did was watch The Lost Boys.
We watched The Lost Boys. Yeah.
Oh,
no,
my
it
God.
Was just the whole thing was really epic. So, hello to Dan Silver. Hello to Katie DeChocho. Good times. Good memories of
that. I did not know this story.
All right. Third touch point on this, after college, after grad school, was living in Brookline, Massachusetts, near the Coolidge Corner Theater, which is this total awesome indie theater. And they used to show this at midnight. And they would do it Rocky Horror Picture Show style.
Oh, nice.
So, you would walk in and they would hand you a bag of stuff that you could throw at the screen. And then they had actors come out in the trench coats with the mullet wigs and whatever and perform the whole Lost Boys in front of the screen.
Oh my God.
Including, they hired this like stripper guy and oiled him up, had him be the sexy sax guy. And he was just, he only has that like one scene in the movie, but they would just bring him out for everything. Like, sex scene, sexy sax guy.
Sexy like, sax guy. Why, like, a sweaty, sexy sax guy was weirdly a fixture in 80s movies. I mean, I definitely noted this. I'm like, Mad Max vibes, hello. Like, I
oh
feel like
God.
Somewhere there was
There's a crossover there. That is Tina Turner's sax guy.
Is it? Of course
and
it is.
He's the one who performed We Don't Need Another Hero. So, yeah, the oiled
oh
up
my
shirtless
God.
Sexy sax
and
guy.
And I swear, there is a leather thong.
In our Mad Max episode.
Yeah, texture of Mad Max has like pretty much lived rent-free in my head since we've seen that movie. and like, I definitely noted, I'm like, I think I just saw a leather thong and there's chains and there's a sweaty sax guy. I'm like, this is major Thunderdome.
Must be Mad Max.
Must be. Like, it's just such a weird thing to have. It's like a trope in the 80s. It's so weird.
And now, my fourth touch point for this episode, I have finally
bought you have it
Lost
right
Boys
here.
On DVD. I paid $6 on Amazon for a used copy of this, and I am so proud to finally own.
Listeners, she's holding it up to the screen so I could see it. Just to make sure that I'm going to have to post a picture. Yeah, so listeners, I will post that to the gram. I'm looking at the picture now. And it's really silly.
I look insane.
You do look a little.
Love it. Yes. That's exactly the photo that deserves.
Amazing.
Oh,
okay, distraction over.
All right.
See, we went from like English Dracula class to I own the DVD now. Yes, so you have an epic four-stage nostalgia for this.
Would you like to give an epically rad plot summary of The Lost Boys?
Epically rad. Yeah, totally. Epically rad with a mullet on. Kind of similar to, folks, we recently reviewed Teen Wolf, which I described as having low-stakes werewolving. So I'd say The Lost Boys, I feel like it has more mid-stakes vampiring, and it's set in a town where dirtbags seem to disappear at an alarming rate, although no one seems that concerned about that. You know, it's mid-stakes, I'd say. It's like more entry-level vampire movies. The world isn't going to end if the good guys don't prevail. You know, just a couple of Corys might be permanent vampires, so those are the stakes.
And we'd have forever Corys.
Oh, we would.
Wherever Corey.
Maybe they should have been vampires.
R.I.P. Corey.
Yeah. You have a couple of Coreys who could be bloodsuckers forever, but they'd still be with us. This just got dark. And still, Diane Weiss, man, she just can't find a man.
She really can't find a good man.
She can't find a good man.
Poor lady.
I think she's looking for a man. My gaydar did not pop with Diane Weist, so just so we know.
No. Poor Diane Weist. A little bit of background on this movie. So this is Joel Schumacher directing, which is why your gaydar may be going off, because he's the guy who put nipples on Batman. Like,
he has
his own aesthetic. He's very into 80s fashion, and yeah. I mean, love him, but...
Nipples on Batman guy. Got it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. His mise-en-scene is very Schumacher-y here. it was written by Janice Fisher and James Jeremias. And once again, this is a movie that was inspired by Interview with a Vampire, which we heard a little bit about by the writer of Groundhog Day. So the writer of this was drawn to the question, what if the reason Peter Pan came out at night and never grew up and could fly is because he was a vampire?
Shut up.
Direct quote.
No way. That is so, I wouldn't have guessed that. That was not on my bingo card that Peter Pan entered the chat.
The first draft of this was so on the nose of Peter Pan that originally the character David was named Peter.
Mm.
And originally the mom was named Wendy.
Mm.
And originally, Sam was John, because you know it's John and Michael are the two kids in that book. And they kept the name Michael, because we chant Michael a lot in this movie. So yeah, they took the exact names out of Peter Pan and put that on the family originally.
Yeah.
And in fact, Nanook the dog in this, remember there's like Nana the dog
Peter Pan.
Like, that comes from that.
I just want to say, listeners, I didn't really read as many of Amanda's notes as I typically do. So this is all surprising new notes.
Surprising.
To me.
Surprising trivia here.
Because I just thought The Lost Boys was just kind of a coincidence that it's Peter Pan-esque.
No, it's totally the idea, of you'll never grow old.
Yeah.
You'll never grow up. Yeah.
I mean,
so
I get
there.
It now.
Yeah.
I get it.
So the first draft of it was about a gang of 12-year-old boys roaming around being vampires.
Not as sexy.
And when they handed the script to Schumacher, and he was like, okay, like the vampires, but what if we make them hot? So we have to age them up a bit.
Give them all square jaws and mullets.
Yeah, we're not doing a 12-year-old hot scene. Mm. So, like, yes, we're going to do this with 18-year-olds, 17 and 18-year-olds. And it's filmed in Santa Cruz, which actually was considered the murder capital of the world. Really? Because they had 3 serial killers pass through in, like, 1 year and killed, like, 30 people.
Oh, wow.
And they said, okay, we're filming the movie here, and we're setting it here. And the town, or the city of Santa Cruz, was like, you are absolutely not calling us Santa Cruz. So they switched it to Santa Carla, but it's, like, so obviously Santa Cruz.
Yeah, and it's definitely that part of California, for sure.
Yeah, my roommate, Kelly, from way back, the postgraduate when we had the cool movie theater near us, era.
For stage 3 of your nostalgia.
Yeah,
of this
for stage 3 of awesome Lost Boysness. But she grew up there and she was just like, yeah, no, we all love this movie. We love that it's set there. But yeah, Santa Cruz is trying to hide behind like a, no, we're not. We're not the murder capital.
Yeah, and just like I mentioned before, some of the Mad Max vibes. I mean, Santa Carla / Santa Cruz. There's some references to the fact that there's like murdery things happening. Otherwise, it's just sort of a party. It's, you know,
like
with
a cool party beach town.
Yeah, but
sexy sax guys randomly playing on the beach every night.
But it's also full of dirtbags. I mean, you definitely get that vibe of like,
yeah,
this is where dirtbags go to hang, and if they get murdered, nobody cares.
Kind of, yeah.
It's like kind of
definitely a bit of that going on.
Yeah, it's a little bit of.
So anyway, nowadays, Santa Cruz totally embraces this movie, and it's one of those, like, outdoor movie events every summer. Bring your chairs and your...
Bring your kids!
Bring your family!
Let's move on to the actual movie. Who is first, Amanda? Who are we talking about?
So, we need to start with Michael, who is Michael Emerson, played by Jason Patrick, who is the most quintessential 80s hot, like...
I mean, so, like, I texted Amanda, I texted Amanda, like, halfway through this movie, and I'm like, Amanda, I have so many questions about this movie. And the first question I have for you, for Jason Patrick, is, I get that I'm a lesbian, but I can get things. Like, I get Christian Slater. I get why Top Gun is appealing. I understand. But can you explain why he is quintessential 80s hot? Like... Just tell me. I don't get it. I know there's a lot of square jaws in this movie, but tell me.
Oh, my God.
Explain it to me, Amanda.
So, all right. We've got 18-year-old Jason Patrick, who has been outfitted with a mullet. He's got the dangly earring. He's got the leather jacket. He's got, like, a bike that he's racing around on. Not particularly well, but whatever.
Whatever.
But, yeah, no, Jason Patrick is just this brooding, building up to that 90s mentality of, I'm too cool, I'm too, like, cynical. He's, you know, he's, like, a brooding 18-year-old guy version of, I don't want to say Wednesday Addams, but like that whole era of cynicism.
Okay.
And yeah, he's not.
Amanda could tell I'm not buying it right now. But
no,
okay.
I'm watching her face here. She is not feeling the Jason Patrick, but one of the participants from our Is Kevin Costner Hot survey already has chimed in and like, oh my God, Jason Patrick. So yes, he is a
thing.
Wait,
but did she think Kevin Costner was hot,
though?
We were
a little too young.
Wait, was she one that thought Kevin Costner
was
hot? She was
on the Kevin Costner is hot.
So, somehow... Yeah.
Whereas I was pro-Christian Slater from that particular argument. But.
So, here's where... It's like, I feel like he's so vanilla. So, folks, Michael is the main protagonist, as you just described. The family is new to town. They just moved there. And he sort of gets mixed up with the Kiefer Sutherland, like, vampires, and he becomes a vampire, blah, blah, blah. He's the main quote-unquote hero, if folks don't remember. I don't know. I get the Christian Slater thing. I do. I kind of feel like my problem with him as 80s hot is that he just, and maybe this is why he was appealing, he's just not as confident and sure of himself. Like, he's kind of, he sort of strikes me as, like, a nerd in a good-looking guy's body. Like,
You're going to hate Pump Up the Volume.
But I don't mind Christian Slater. I just don't. I get it because he's just not, like, he felt like kind of a nothing to me.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, no, whatever he does in this movie, I think this is entirely coming from a place of, like, how he looks. He is making these, like, sultry, sulking faces the whole movie. And I think that was what we considered hot in the 80s. And I need to preface, I was too young when I saw this movie to be like, ooh, Jason Patrick. I was more like, ooh, Corey Feldman. But now watching this and... as an adult looking back, being like, oh, wait, no, Jason Patrick's like way hotter than Corey Feldman. No offense to either of you. You are both very attractive people.
Yeah, no, I registered that he's good looking. I guess I feel like from an appeal standpoint, I feel like the Corey Feldman's more appealing because he's just funny. And I honestly, like, part of me was like, Star, who's like the female lead, I feel like you should stick with Kiefer Sutherland. Like, I feel like he's more interesting than this guy. I don't know. Sorry. Sorry to all the straight ladies of my generation. I just don't see it, guys. I don't see it.
So, actor Jason Patrick did not want to be in this movie. Thought this was, like, stupid and a bad character. And Joel Schumacher met with him, like, every day for weeks trying to sell this case. Like, no, you gotta do this.
Aren't there other hot 80s movie, 80s guys he could have cast? I mean, I'm just, I don't know, man.
He had his heart set on Jason Patrick. Okay. All right, I do need to tell you that when I was studying abroad in Dublin, I went to see Jason Patrick perform in a play. Oh, and so cool. This is post Rush and post Speed 2, which was freaking terrible. We're not going to do that on this podcast. Post, what was that? Sleepers. His roles got more interesting as he went along, except for Speed 2. but he was in this play that I saw at the Gate Theater in Dublin, and he was dressed as like the accountant character. Like, they made him be a nerd, and he was phenomenal. Like, he's just a really good actor. So I think this was not his comfort zone, being the, like, pinup, you know, Tiger Beat magazine, everybody hearts Jason Patrick with his mullet and his dangly earring.
Yeah,
so, I have a lot of respect for him, but, like, in this rewatch, I was like, oh, yeah, no, he's definitely the hottest guy in this movie.
No, I totally register that he's a good-looking guy. I think his character generally just sort of moves the plot along, but he's just not that compelling. Like, I guess I agree with Jason Patrick. I think he might have been better off as, like, one of the bad guys, because I think the character itself is kind of a nothing. I mean, you could relate to it a little bit. One thing I did see in your notes, like, you kind of relate to the peer pressure aspect. Like, he's new to the town and all that stuff.
Yeah. This was the first viewing that I thought he was being a total dick to his mom also. Mm. Like, it hadn't jumped out at me before, but, like, he's just, like, an asshole teenager in this movie. The way he comes rolling in and doesn't want to talk to her and is, like, keeping his shades on and not making eye contact. That came across this viewing.
I don't have the nostalgia for it, but to me, he's the least memorable part of this movie.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, with that, we should keep going through the rest of the characters here. Jason Patrick plays Michael Emerson, and Corey Haim plays Sam Emerson, his younger brother, who, holy shit, his clothes.
Holy shit, his clothes.
I have never seen.
I got to do a slideshow on the socials to just remind people how loud and proud his clothes are. They're like, they're oversized. They're neon. Ugh.
Director just described this character as mall fashion victim.
It's so good.
In that era, because that's right around, we're a little bit ahead of when Zach Morris is coming onto the scene from Saved by the Bell, but this is a very Saved by the Bell fluorescent, got huge patterns and, like, very bleachy hair and just craziness going on. Every scene he walks in, he's wearing something even weirder.
It's almost distracting, his clothes. They're so bizarre.
It's so distracting, his clothes.
I was like, the costume person just went nuts. Like, they just, give me the boldest pattern you have, but, you know, make it tacky. I don't know. So he's the little brother, and he also has the whole, I'm new to this town. He's just figuring this out. He kind of has the nerdy edge. He's hanging out in comic book stores. He's a comic book guy.
Yeah, he's a little dorky, even though he seems to think he's the shit. I can't figure out how old this kid is supposed to be. You know, like, I can look at how old Corey Haim was, but I'm not sure. Because there's that scene where he's in the bathtub singing along to the music, and I just can't figure out, is he supposed to be 8? Is he supposed to be 15? What is happening
here? So this was another question that I had for you, Amanda, as someone who has seen this a lot. The scene has no bearing on the plot. I think it's just that he's in the bathroom taking a bath while his brother is basically transitioning to a vampire, so he doesn't notice.
And then about to kill him.
And about to kill him,
They set it in the bathtub, I think, because that would be a very vulnerable place to get attacked by a vampire while you're just like chilling in the bathtub. Yeah, but like, this is a weird scene.
It's a weird scene. I 100% agree with you. He's like playing with toys in the bathtub. My 7-year-old son doesn't even play like that in the bathtub anymore. He's just like, wee! He kind of reminded me of the character from Pee Wee Herman in his giant bathtub playing with his toys as an adult.
Kind of. Ooh.
Yeah. But, and yeah, I had the same thought. I was like, one, how old is he supposed to be? And then I guess this leads to my next question. I was like, is he supposed to be a hot one too? Because then I think it's creepy about how they portray him weirdly young here. Is he also 80s hot? I don't get it.
My guess is he's supposed to be like a tween or like a 13-year-old or something that age. And that whoever wrote this movie does not have kids and does not have any understanding that teenagers don't have a bath time before they
and end. They don't play with toys in the bath when they're like a dween. Like, that's just
maybe that was just like a holdover from a younger character on that previous script where they were all supposed to be 12-year-old and younger. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, no, that is totally a weird scene. But yeah, this character, Sam, is the one who's, like, aligning with the vampire killers, and he just is, like, the smartass of the whole film. He's got a bunch of quips that some of them actually still landed for me. There was something about when he and Michael are downstairs and he realizes Michael doesn't have a reflection, and he's just like, "You're a goddamn vampire! Wait till I tell Mom!" Oh. And storms up the stairs. That just comes across as something a pair of brothers actually would yell at each other before slamming a door.
Yeah, no.
I like that line still.
He definitely captures little brother in a fun way. I like that he's nerdy. To me, he was just more fun, actually, than Michael in some ways. But then, you know, as you referenced, I mean, there's a lot of, like, gaydar bells going off in my head here while I'm watching this.
He has a pinup poster of Rob Lowe in his closet.
And I feel like the camera lingers on the poster for a weirdly long time.
It jumps out at you.
Yeah, like they're really trying to bring home the point. They're like, this kid is a fashion victim and look in his closet. Look over here. We're going to just rest the camera on the Rob Lowe poster for a long time. I'm like, no, okay. Like,
the official reason for that was that Joel Schumacher had just directed St. Elmo's Fire with Rob Lowe in it. And it was a sly promotion of St. Elmo's Fire. But also, Joel Schumacher was gay. So it's like a sly, like, we're absolutely going to stick Rob Lowe in the closet here.
Yeah, in the closet. There's no bearing on the plot here. But I was watching it. I was like,
absolutely pops out at you. Like, what the hell is the Rob Lowe poster doing in this kid's bedroom closet?
Yeah. A kid today or a tween today wouldn't, I don't know if they would pick up on it in some ways because kids could be more out these days. Because I think they would just pick up, it would just go over their heads.
Yeah. Let's round out the Emerson family.
Let's do it.
Diane Wiest is playing their mom, Lucy Emerson, and they're all rolling into town because she has just gotten a divorce and has not gotten
a good man
out of it. So she's moving in with her kooky dad in their weird taxidermy-filled ranch.
Okay, I need to pause.
I don't know where they are.
I know we need to talk about a kooky dad of Diane Wiest, but I gotta pause on the kooky dad. So they're in Grandpa's house. Grandpa, like, just shuffles around, talks about the rules, talks about getting laid sometimes, has creepy shit all over his house, and then at the end of the day, he kind of saves the day. And you find out that he knows the whole time that the town is full of vampires, because you have these subtle things in the background where he's building a fence, and it's actually like a wooden, sort of like a sharp wooden stake.
He's building them like stakes.
Yeah. And he's building it around his property, so you kind of have these like subtle hints along the way, but basically he's known the whole time. It's like the kooky weird grandpa in the background. I love grandpa. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they arrive at the house. Okay, new in town, like had to come here because didn't get any money in the divorce and have nowhere to live, and he's playing dead on the front porch.
Oh, that's right! It was like...
And they're kind of like towing him. Did he die? What happened here? And he's like, ha ha!
He's so weird. I love Kooky
Very
Grandpa.
Weird.
Yeah, I love it.
Kooky Grandpa is adorable.
I'd watch a prequel of Kooky Grandpa discovering about the vampires and they come to some sort of detente. But anyway. But we're not, but yes, Diane Wiest. Divorced
Diane
a
Wiest.
Shitty man, still can't find a good man, apparently.
Can't find a good man, rolling into her weird dad's house with all the taxidermy. And, okay, Diane Wiest, months before, won an Oscar.
What did she win for?
That Woody Allen movie, Hannah and Her Sisters.
Oh, okay.
No, Hannah and Her Sisters. So okay. She won an Oscar in 1986.
And this was her next movie.
And then, had the Oscar in hand, and they called her, like, you want to be the mom in The Lost Boys? And she was like, yeah, I'll do it.
Oh my God. So we've talked about Diane Weiss before. She was the mom in Edward Scissorhands. And we loved her in that as well.
She's like favorite 80s mom. Absolutely. She's just so nice every time. And then she like has her flip out moments and just loses her mind. And she's so good at it.
She is good at it.
She's way too naive in this movie. She's a sweetheart and just so nice to everybody. And like you see her when they roll into town. She's giving money to homeless children who are dumpster diving. She's just shuffling around kind of ineffectually.
She's kind of that character in other movies too. I don't think she was discernibly that different from her character in Parenthood or Edward Scissorhands. I mean, she is.
Yeah.
They don't really give her enough to do here. And the reason why I think I enjoyed her so much in this is because I just know how good she is. And she's good at what she's given, but she does not have a lot of screen time. I actually find her ineptness or her like inability to see what's really going on, I find to be really amusing. Like, she's pretty good at that.
Yeah, no, and she just comes across as such a sweet, nice, kind person, which all of her movies, she does that. Actually, I'm sure she's got like some evil characters in there somewhere.
I need to see her as a bad guy in something.
Ooh, actually, you know what she's good at? Practical Magic. She's like one of the witches. I don't think I've seen that. But yeah, this movie, she's divorced. She just wants to go on a date so badly. And she just, you know, she like needs a job. And she's got these two idiot teenage boys.
She does.
Screwing things up for her over and over again. Just can't catch a break. I thought she was great. Like, just watching her add so much heart to these kind of generic lines that she was given to read, it's really charming to watch her. So, love Diane Weiss once again.
I think she makes this movie better. I'd stop short as to say that this is a great movie, but I think, I do think that, like, if there were somebody else in that role that was a nothing, and we've, you know, had nothing characters before, I actually think it would degrade the movie. I mean, you kind of...
Yeah.
She does have great screen presence. She's pretty genuine when she's upset that her teenagers are drifting away from her. I guess as a parent, I could relate to it, but there wasn't enough there. I mean, there could have been more.
All right. So that's the Emerson family. They are arriving from Arizona into the murder capital of the world and just casually going to sexy sax man concerts on the
beach.
Very
casual. Yep. It's
good times. But we have to run into some bad guys here, starting with Kiefer Sutherland as David.
Classic.
Which I love him in this. He's amazing. And he had just rolled off of Stand By Me. Like, he wrapped that and immediately started on this movie. And it's kind of the same bully vibe.
It is.
Like, he's got this really conniving, but it's something about this role is really, it's almost like he's got a little cult. And you can see why people are gravitating towards him. He's just cool. I don't know.
He is cool.
And he's got the mullet and he's got the long trench coat and the motorcycle and whatever's going on. There's just coolness oozing out of him.
There really is. And I loved him in this. I thought he was good. And again, I am not the nostalgia for this movie. Yeah, he exudes cool. He is a classic bully in a way, but he's like weirdly compelling. I think you hit the nail on the head, the cult leader. You're really drawn to him and you kind of get it. Like, I kind of get it. And if folks don't remember, obviously, he's like, you know, one of the leader vampires riding around on his bike and he's egging Michael on. He's really, he's a bad guy and there's no depth beyond the fact that he's a bad guy. But for some reason, he makes it really compelling.
I would put him up there. Like, he's not quite Alan Rickman level of best bad guy, but he was a really good bad guy in so many movies when we were a kid.
And he was just
and
cool.
And he's got charisma and coolness.
I think he's, like, cooler than Michael. I like him better than Michael, the vanilla character. Like, in some way. You know, I'm rooting for the bad guy, I guess. Like, in the last episode, I was very pro-cat in American Tail. he's so compelling to me. He overshadows him.
Yeah, we talked about this in Die Hard because I was saying that I was worried there wouldn't be that balance between Alan Rickman and Bruce Willis. And then in rewatching it, it was like, no, they're very well balanced. I think you have a point here that Yeah, Kiefer Sutherland is pulling a total Heath Ledger on this. And, like, get out of there, Batman. We just want to see the Joker. Like, what's David doing? Let's go back to David.
Yeah, I think that's what happened here.
All right. There's a trivia point that he, in real life, broke his hand doing a wheelie on his motorcycle while they were filming this. So they had to put black leather gloves on him to hide the cast, because he's got, like, a broken wrist.
Yeah.
And, like, it just goes with his whole persona, like the badass black leather gloves. So even him screwing up still looks cool.
I think another reason why I found him compelling, I was thinking about this afterwards, like, not to go too deep into it, but, you know, this is sort of an After Dark episode. So he's bad, you know, he's murdering people, you know, he's not just a bad guy. This is kind of a weird analogy, but sort of similar to Dark Crystal, where, you know, if from a kid's perspective, you're like, I think the bad guys could win. He has this element of, like, you know, when they're going to the bridge, the iconic bridge scene, and they're hanging off the bridge and letting go. I mean, obviously, you don't really think the main character's going to die, but you're sort of just like, I don't know, man, anything can fucking happen here. Because he seems, he's not unhinged, but he just is completely reckless with things. And so you kind of have this feeling of, like, anything could happen, good guys could die.
Well, he's doing unhinged things, but he's speaking so slowly and so carefully. It's got that Hannibal Lecter pacing to it. Like, we're gonna do this. Aren't you gonna do this, Michael? We're all doing this, Michael. And it just builds. Like, how do you say no to that?
How do you say no to that? And how it goes to the peer pressure. And I just want to say, he's not a Hannibal Lecter. Like, he's not the depth of brilliance of
he
Anthony Hopkins
here. He does eat people, though. He absolutely eats people.
But he does eat people, you're right. But he's not, like, I guess I kind of, like, was compelled by the fact that he was, like, not unhinged, but maybe. I think he'd kill a kid and eat it. Like, I mean, he would do anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this character, David, played by Kiefer Sutherland, actually does not have that many lines in the movie at all. It's all a lot of facial reaction and staring and posing, which I saw your note that you thought this was kind of like a glam rock music video the whole time.
Oh, yeah. Very.
But they let like him have the cool line at the end of the scene. So it feels like he had all this cool dialogue, but it's just a lot of silence and then him just saying, you don't have to beat me, you just have to keep up.
It's a good line.
And then cut to a bike, you know, chase across the beach kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it feels like he gets the final word intentionally.
Yeah, and it works. And he's good at it. And I'm going to say it still lands, even though I don't have that memory of the first time it might have landed, but it still lands to modern sensibilities, I think, in some ways. Yeah, I would see a prequel.
They made it so that you see with the other vampires when they get staked or death by stereo at one point, however they're killing the vampires. But David's character, the rest of them, like, explode when they get killed, and David doesn't. And they left that there intentionally. He doesn't turn into a bloody mess, gory, blow up a toilet kind of vampire death. He was supposed to survive because they had the sequel lined up, The Lost Girls, that they never made, but they were going to bring him back.
Interesting.
David might still be out there, people.
I see a reboot coming.
Check those wanted posters, or not wanted, but, like, you know, your milk carton kids there.
The milk carton thing, just a sidebar on that, like, so throughout the movie.
Yes, please.
There, you see these missing, like, you know, just because in the background you see these random things like murder capital, or, like, you kind of have this background that this is a crime infested place, you know, dirtbags are dying. And then you see, like, these missing posters, and milk cartons have missing pictures. And then some of those people featured in the pictures do show up as vampires or something else. But there's something kind of weird about it. Like, I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm an adult now. It felt not cringe, but it felt over the line to me for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, time out. Can we talk about in the 80s, they used to put missing children's pictures on milk cartons.
That's weird. And you're right.
Eating your breakfast cereal and there would be, like, missing this 8-year-old, full picture in black and white, and then nutritional information.
Blah, 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 calories. This is calcium, good for your bones. 10%.
Yay. Like, Oh my God. Thought that was an okay thing to be doing. What was wrong with the 1980s that
thought
milk cartons was an appropriate place to put missing children photos?
I mean, I guess it's a good place. I that is something where, like, we register it in our generation of, like, we remember that. But I bet a teen or a kid today, they would be weirded out even more. Like, what the fuck is that doing on a milk carton? It's so weird.
Yeah. We didn't have a better way to get out the word, hey, we're looking for this kid, other than put the printed picture on a milk carton.
I mean, maybe when you don't have the internet and social media, all you got are milk cartons. I don't know. Ew. But though these days, it's like, I don't know. There's like, do different types of kids end up on the regular milk versus the oat milk versus the almond milk? I mean, there's too many milk cartons these days. You couldn't do it.
Yeah. Who's on the soy milk? And were they vegan before they disappeared? Because inquiring minds.
I mean, I feel like I don't care about the soy milk kids. It's gross milk.
Oh my god, the 80s were weird. All right, we gotta keep talking about some other characters here. We've got the other Corey. He's got a brother in this one. We've got Edgar and Alan Frog, and these names are supposed to be an Edgar Allan Poe.
Okay. I guess I get it.
This was Corey Feldman, who was in Stand By Me and came off that and immediately jumped into this movie along with Kiefer Sutherland. And then Jamie Newlander, who I think this is his first movie. I don't remember.
He did not look familiar to me.
After this. Yeah. But I think at the time I would have been a very pro Corey Feldman. Like, he's the dreamy Tiger Beat magazine pinup for me at that age. I definitely remember him from Stand By Me. He had the dorky glasses.
He was also in Goonies.
He was in Goonies. Yep.
Yeah.
Wait. Classic. Oh, I got to tell you this. So do you remember back when Facebook would like recommend friends to you based on people you friended?
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Like, this was early Facebook. Like, yeah. Oh, you may also like, it was a weird recommendation feature they had. The final movie I did was with Joey Pants, who plays one of the bad guys in Goonies.
Oh, yeah.
He used to come over to my desk while we were filming this indie flick, and I had Advil in my desk, so he'd stand there and pop a few because his back was driving him nuts.
Yeah.
And then we'd just like chat, and he was like, oh, you gotta be my friend on Facebook. So I friended him on Facebook, and then they were like, you may also want to be friends with Corey Feldman.
Get out of here.
I was like, oh, hell yes, and went to like friend him. Officially, you could only have 5,000 friends on Facebook at that time. No. And Corey Feldman already had 5,000 friends. So
you did not make the cut.
I did not get to be Facebook friends with Corey Feldman because Corey Feldman had too many friends. I've been frozen out of Facebook, but I think I'm still friends with Joey Pants on there. So, hello.
Hello, Joey Pants.
If you hear us.
Yes, Amanda's not
still
on the socials.
Still love your work, too. We'll do Goonies. We'll talk about you soon. So, we've got the Frog Brothers in this movie. They were told by the director that their characters are supposed to be, like, very militant. And they made Corey Feldman go watch a bunch of Rambo movies before this and told him to do an impression of Rambo.
Right. I was going to say, the weird thing that sort of bothered me about him in this is his purposeful deep voice.
It's a Stallone impression. Like, he's not talking normal, and it's weird.
It's weird. And at this point, he would have been famous before this movie, right? I mean, he's...
Yes. Yeah.
So why would you do that? And it was almost distracting, too, now watching as an adult, because you remember him in all these other movies. I'm like, why is he, like, purposely speaking in a lower octave that I know he doesn't have? It's so weird. So I liked him in this. I liked the brothers, and they're the ones that they are the nerds with the other Corey. They're the first kids that the other secretly gay Corey that has a Rob Lowe poster in his closet meets. So Corey Feldman and his brother in this, they're hanging out at the comic book store. They clearly know what's going on with the vampires. They're basically like, hey, you have to Sam, you have to read this comic book, which is about vampires. They're giving him a guide to surviving vampire attacks. So they're like the helper characters who know what's going on. They're trying to suss out who the main vampire is. They know all the vampire rules and how to kill them. Again, here I feel like there's not enough of them, and he has like a weird low octave voice. But I did enjoy when they were on screen. It was fun. It was more fun when they were in the scenes.
Yeah, the director told them, these two take themselves so seriously, but they're the comic relief of this movie, but they don't realize how funny they are. So just play this as serious as possible. This is a life or death mission. You guys watch way too many like Chuck Norris and Rambo movies, and that's your vibe.
There's essence of Goonies too in the way that they kind of are.
There is. Yeah, they're going down into the vampire cave.
They are sort of funny. Like they find out where the cave is, and these two brothers, they come with backpacks full of like supplies, but no plan. You know, they just basically go into this cave, find the vampires, and just start stabbing people like without any plan. And it's funny. I mean,
yeah. And it gets gross really quickly. Although it does. I was looking at the special effects on this because once again, no CGI back then. They took the fake blood for this and they put glitter in it. And I noticed it this time before I even read that. We have a little bit of sparkly vampire vibe going on here. But the Frog Brothers come running out of this cave after they've killed a vampire and he explodes all over them. And they're just covered in glitter. And they're both like, oh, we screwed up. And like,
yeah,
making a big scene. I thought that whole thing was really funny. It takes the serious and like they try to make certain scenes really grotesque in this movie. But the two of them running out of that cave covered in like ooze and blood and sparkles just looks so funny.
I like it too. I think my mind fills in the blanks from what I love about Goonies and some of the other hijinks kind of characters they're supposed to kind of emulate. It's probably above average. There's not enough of them, but it makes the movie more enjoyable. I mean, they're the ones also in the montage at the end when they're preparing for the final battle. They're stealing holy water from a church and filling a bat, which is funny. And they're filling water, you know, water guns with it. It landed, but yet I've seen better versions of it. Like, I've seen better versions of Corey Feldman, but I still liked it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, Corey Feldman is not performing particularly well in this movie. He was, as an actor, very coked up on set, apparently. Like, he was going through his childhood actor with a drug habit phase.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's over the top and ridiculous.
I got precursor to Stranger Things vibes from them. In some ways,
I mean, they're riding around on bikes.
They're riding around on bikes.
And that one's,
yeah. I bet there's references to them in Stranger Things in some ways that I haven't picked up.
I really would love to see everyone in this movie cast in the final season of Stranger Things. You know how they like pop in 80s actors?
Yeah, like Sean Austin is in there. I mean, they already had another Goonies actor in there, so.
Oh my God. Let's make this happen, guys.
Hollywood listens to this podcast. We've sort of manifested the title of the Beetlejuice movie from this podcast.
We did. So. We did say that before it was released. Yeah. Are you ready to talk about our favorite 80s actor with the punchable face?
I did not know he was in this, so I was surprised.
When we did our Overboard episode and I saw Edward Herrmann pop up, I was like, oh, that's Max from The Lost Boys. Yes.
Which is so funny because like when he popped up in Lost Boys, I'm like, it's Grant
from Overboard. Oh, we love hate Edward Herrmann. I mean, we love him, but like his characters are always just awful.
But then it made it kind of funny in watching this because I was when there's a scene where he runs a video store. He goes on a date with Diane Wiest. Basically, what's happening at home is that, like, Sam is finding out his brother's a vampire and, like, calls the restaurant, which, by the way, is funny. You have to, like, call a restaurant, not a cell phone. So a kid today would be very confused about that. But then she's like, oh, my God, my kids are, I don't know what's happening. She basically runs out on Grant in the middle of a date. And I actually laughed out loud because I was like, I'm calling him Grant. But anyway, she runs out on Max. And I just thought it was really funny. I was like, yeah, that's what you get, Max, for being a dick in that other movie. That.
Yes. You deserve that from Overboard.
Right. And I
a number of other movies where you play the jerk.
And because I didn't remember this movie, I was like, oh, there's this whole plot where like Corey Feldman and they kind of suspect he's the head vampire guy, but then they give him all sorts of tests, which is a really funny scene where like the Frog Brothers are basically at Diane Wiest's house for dinner and they're testing, I'm going to call him Grant. They're like, you know, throwing, I don't even know how they're testing him. They're like putting him in front of they're giving him garlic.
And garlic. Like, yeah. Garlic in his food. They hold up a mirror. They turn out the lights.
And it's kind of funny. I mean, the whole thing is really funny. And I was like, it would be really funny if he was actually the bad guy. Like totally forgetting that he actually is really the bad guy at the end.
So his character runs the video store where Lucy, Diane Wiest's character, gets a job, but then they kind of start like dating sort of, but it keeps getting disrupted by her two insane teenage children. I saw this video of him today because I was watching like a interview the cast members, you know, 30 years after The Lost Boys came out. And he said he was really happy that he was playing a character that didn't have to wear a suit and be a banker type. And then he had this quote, he was really happy to, quote, play a sexy guy. Oh. And he's so not sexy in this, sadly. Like, he's wearing tragic 80s, just, I can't even, it's like sweater vesty kind of.
But it also doesn't stand out. Like, if you were him for Halloween, you wouldn't get it, because there's nothing sexy or iconic about what he's wearing or what he acts like. It's so funny, he thought he's the sexy one in this, when you've just described that all the other 80s heartthrobs are in this movie. Well, and no, he's not one of them.
He thought this was like the sexiest character he'd ever played, basically.
I mean,
doesn't make him the sexiest character in this movie, and it doesn't make him sexy, but, you know, for his type of characters, the guy with the punchable face, this is probably as good as it got.
Yeah, probably.
He's bringing sort of a weird vibe, but like an absolutely appropriate weird vibe to this role. It popped into my head later, the idea that she goes to him for a job, he hires her, and then they're immediately dating.
Yeah, there's
something
a little
you
cringe.
Wouldn't see happen anymore, but you know, 1987.
Yeah.
There were no rules.
It's kind of cringe. And like the whole point at the end, the big reveal is that he wants to date her and turn her into a vampire. So she's essentially like a slave mother to his vampire boys.
That she's Wendy to the
Wendy,
last
yeah. That she's Wendy, but like a weird coerced vampire Wendy who murders people. So like, I don't know. That part is like a little cringe, but I'll allow it because he's a villain.
I do like that he's attracted to her because she has a good heart.
Yeah. But then he, you know, he also tries to turn her kids into vampires so she has no choice.
He does, yeah. That was a little manipulative.
A little bit. But, you know, in a weird way, I think that if you're going to weigh the villainy of vampire, what's his name? Max?
Max.
To asshole rich Grant and Overboard, I'd say that Grant is the bigger villain if you had to compare.
I probably have more sympathy with Max here.
Yeah, I mean, Grant's like, you know, he left his wife, he pretended he didn't know who she was, so.
And Max is the total opposite. He just wants one big happy family, as he explains at the end.
Yeah, I mean.
You have to kill a lot of people to get there, but that's all he wanted.
Be super manipulative family. To get there, but, you know.
Yeah. Mm. All right, we have a couple more characters that we're gonna, like, fly through real quick, because they're not given enough screen time, but they are notable. Star is played by Jamie Gertz. She's supposed to be the love interest. They do not give her anything to do in this.
I learned some vampire rules in this movie, and she was sort of the
guy. Well, no. You learned the Lost Boy vampire rules. We can go back to Mr. Yassi's class. Every single vampire movie has its own rules. Like, the fact that they serve Max garlic at that dinner scene should have killed him. If you're playing by traditional.
But no, but he was invited in. So
But that shouldn't matter necessarily.
Okay.
And that was another thing. They invited, or Michael invited Max in. So, okay, Max is allowed in the house. But Star just walks right through the window pane at one point, and it's just like, no one invited her in.
I actually had this conversation this past weekend, and Lost Boys came up because about vampire rules. And the rule of if you invite a vampire in, then all the other rules sort of get of how to kill that vampire get negated. So,
yeah.
And I was like, oh, I know this one. I know this one because I just watched The Lost Boys. I'm like, they invite Grant in. And everyone's like, who's Grant? But, you know, whatever.
Well, I learned that from Mr. Yassi.
Mr. Yassi.
Invite the vampires in.
I was like kind of unsure. Like, is she trying to recruit him? Because, so she and Michael kind of have an attraction, right? And they eventually hook up. At first, I was like, damn, that was cold as fuck. She just turned this guy into a vampire so she can get laid. Like, she's the villain in this movie, you know?
Yeah, well, no, she's the honeypot. She's the vampire honeypot.
I guess
they
so.
They send her out to pick him up.
To lure him in.
She's luring him in. The one thing, though, her character, so Michael gets bit by the dog and has his hand ripped open, and then he hooks up with her, and his hand is magically fixed. So apparently she's amazing in the sack.
So, yeah, I think she was kind of a nothing character, although except when I made up this plot in my mind that she was the real villain because she just liked him and wanted him to be a vampire so she could be with him. But at the same time, I was like, why are you doing that, Star? Kiefer Sutherland's way more interesting and cool. But anyway.
So I bet after this movie ends, that Diane Wiest's super nice mom, Lucy, is just like, yeah, you and Laddie, come live here. So I bet, like, Star and Laddie are all living in the taxidermy house.
Yeah, let's...
Michael and Sam after.
I didn't actually come up with epilogues for folks for this movie the way I did for Teen Wolf, but maybe that's their epilogue. They're just living as hippies in Santa Cruz somewhere. You know, they're selling t-shirts on the beach.
Real life epilogue for Jamie Gertz, who's the actress who plays Star here. 2 years after this movie, she married a billionaire, and she owns the Milwaukee Brewers.
Get out of here! That's crazy! Because I was like, oh, this woman doesn't look familiar at all to me, but I guess, okay. Hey, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
She's got a good epilogue compared to her character.
But I'd like to think of her as the real villain. She just thought Jason Patrick was okay. Hot. And wanted to sleep with him, and that was...
She's secretly manipulated this whole thing.
This whole
thing. Kill off these vampires, but we're gonna, like, save me so I can go live in your taxidermy house. Yes.
That's right.
I'm bringing the weird kid from the milk carton. We also have to give a shout out to the character Marco, who I don't think he has any lines, but this is Alex Winter, a.k.a. the other guy from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So Alex Winter... is one of the vampires who's striking a pose behind Kiefer Sutherland.
So many a pose, he totally
I mean,
is.
That's what they're really doing. They're just, like, strutting onto a merry-go-round, and then they're, like, posing with backlit fog and just looking fucking cool. But it's, you're right, it's a huge music video.
Yeah, it's just an 80s ballad video, tapestry kind of thing. But, yeah.
So... I did hear a audio clip about them talking about the special effects in this, and that the scene where Alex Winter's character gets staked through the heart, he's wearing these contact lenses that they were all told, like, you could only have them in for 5 minutes and then you gotta get them out of your eyes. So they're like, every like cut, all of these actors are like popping the contacts out.
Yeah.
He described it as if you cut a pong ball in half and shoved it into your eye.
Ugh.
That's what we're dealing with 1980s special effects contact lenses. But the scene where he gets the stake and falls to the ground, and then the Corys are kind of...
They're like, oh shit, we don't have,
like,
a plan.
Screaming. Yeah, no plan. That they apparently, like, kicked rocks and dirt into the ping pong ball contact lenses, and that they had to take him offset with, like, massive corneal abrasions. Like, he got wicked hurt on that.
Oh, no.
Like, unintentional method acting, but yes, they nearly killed Alex Winter and blinded him in that shot.
And wait, this movie came out after Bill and Ted, right? Bill and Ted is...
No, just before Bill and Ted.
Oh, okay. So just before.
First movie? I wrote in the things I think are good about this movie that do live up and last. I think there's a very compelling and relatable story about being sucked into a crowd as a teenager. Like, that you want to go do what the cool kids are doing, and then it turns into something that you suddenly are uncomfortable with, but you can't let it go.
Yeah, you're like
in
over your head.
Yeah.
Because there's something, I know we just reviewed Teen Wolf a couple of episodes ago, and that was something that I think could still resonate, is like, for Teen Wolf, it's like the stakes are being embarrassed and feeling, I'm only average. When can I not be average? I just want to be kind of cool. And there's something forever relatable about that. It's the kind of timeless. And I think you're totally right. It's an entry-level vampire movie, but it's sort of like an entry-level teen movie too. There is something about falling in with the crowd that... in this particular case, just happens to be murdery vampires run by a video store owner. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Ooh, peer pressure right there. And you keep mentioning Teen Wolf, which I was critiquing for being low budget and they only shot it in like 20 days or whatever. This movie was also shot in 21 days. And
really?
Just feels, looks, everything about it just seems more movie-like than Teen Wolf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair.
They got the cinematographer from Taxi Driver to shoot this. Mm-hmm. And even though it's definitely the 80s, like the opening shot, they're coming in overhead and it's got to be like a helicopter shot or something. And it's a little shaky. So I was just like, whoa, life before drone cameras. Like,
I had that same thought because there are a lot of overhead shots and long zooms. They did not have drones. Like, obviously they didn't in the 80s.
Yeah.
So it probably took a lot of technical know-how to do those kind of shots.
That Yeah. They had to have a cinematographer who knew how to do either helicopter or some of them do look like high-level crane shots. But yeah. Doing that at night also is really technically challenging. So I thought that was really cool that they kind of recreated, I'm calling it the Jaws effect. You don't ever see the vampires fly in from above and grab somebody, but you see the reaction shot of people who are being attacked on the ground looking up as the camera swoops in on them. So it's kind of like Jaws with just the shot of the legs where you don't see the shark right. A little bit.
I thought that was clever. I thought it was clever.
Another kind of technical thing I really like here is they really set what we think vampires look like for the rest of the 90s here. They're using foam latex with paint and, you know, making people's faces have very angular, bony looks when they turn into vampires, and some dentures with the teeth and that. That's what Buffy the Vampire Slayer grabbed and ran with. Mm. And, like, that is what we think vampire, when you turn into a vampire, that's what you look like.
Yeah.
And this is the movie that set that up versus Salem's Lot, where the vampires were kind of blue and their teeth were square-shaped. The vampires in that movie were so creepy-looking, but just almost, I don't know, demonic. All right, well, do we want to talk about, we always like to do this, but things that suck or are cringy?
I didn't actually have any notes about sucky or cringy. I mean, it is...
Okay.
I think a lot of it just doesn't always rise to the level of great, I would say. But it's... There's my note. I didn't hate it.
Yeah. It's all over the map in terms of levels of things that suck or cringy. But, like, some of them aren't that serious. Like, my constant nitpicking, nobody is wearing a helmet in this movie. Yes, I get the vampires.
Concussions for everyone!
You don't know that in the beginning. Michael, where's your damn helmet?
Yeah.
But you didn't end up with three concussions like Pee-wee.
No, you just ended up being a vampire. That. It's fine.
Just a vampire. Yeah. Whoops.
There's no helmet for that.
If you had a concussion, you just hook up with Star. She'll fix you right up.
Yep.
This does fail the Bechdel test big time. So just a reminder to anyone who knows that term. Movies that have female characters who have speaking lines, who are talking to each other occasionally and not talking about the guy they're in love with.
Mm.
This movie is very bro-y. I mean, it's called The Lost Boys. Of course it's very bro-y. But yeah, you've got two kind of ineffectual female characters in this.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's talk about things that are great, because we like to end on a high note.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond the actors, we have some crazy ass 80s fashion going on and some crazy ass hair, and just the whole vibe of the setting in this movie puts you in such a specific place, and I do really enjoy. You're just so clearly taking it out of wherever you're watching this movie and dropped into Santa Clara with all of this nonsense going on. I like it. This is a great escapism movie.
I think a great escapism movie is a good way to put it. We said at the beginning, nostalgia, when one of us does not have nostalgia for a movie, it doesn't fare particularly well. And I know I've been like beating up on it, but I was in. I kind of was compelled. I wasn't like, oh my God, this is so painful.
Like you were with American Tail.
Right. Or honestly, Mad Max or Guys, or Babes in Toyland or things like that.
Babes in Toyland is totally terrible.
It's totally terrible. I mean, I even felt this way about Pee-wee, even though I do have nostalgia for that. But I think the world this created, I kind of bought in and was entertained by it. I felt like I accepted it for what it is. Like, this is kind of going to be just a little bit above B-level and might be a little bit of fun. And I think it does pay off on that. Whether you think Jason Patrick's attractive or not, I think it still pays off on it. Yeah.
Yeah, that...
I'm going to get hate mail for this. I could feel it.
Only from the Kevin Costner fans.
the demographic that is like the Jason Patrick, Kevin Costner fans. Oh my God. There were parts that were funny, like the death by garlic water, the Corey Feldman stealing shit.
Oh wait, and we need to describe this. So the final act of this movie, the vampire gang is coming to their house to attack them. It's a very violent Home Alone setup, this final act.
That is like exactly what it is.
The vampires are coming in. So they set up all these traps. We've got a bathtub full of holy water.
With garlic inside.
We've got all these steaks all over the house. And what Jess is describing is one of the vampires goes to attack one of the quarries. And the dog, Nanook, jumps out of nowhere and, like, tackles the vampire into the bathtub full of holy water and garlic. And not only does he, like, dissolve and explode at the same time, but his blood somehow gets sucked into the plumbing system and then explodes out of the toilet in the most comical, ridiculous, over-the-top way possible.
It's sort of that horror, amazing. Like, the horror-level blood is unreal. There's just, like...
Yeah, they just go full gory grotesque at the end.
Every pipe has pieces of this poor schmuck vampire who falls into this tub. I mean, it is like every pipe explodes with vampire guts, but it's funny, I have to say.
It's funny. You know? And then you think, okay, that's going to be like the best epic vampire death. No, immediately we're battling another vampire and somehow throw him back into the stereo equipment, and then he explodes and there's blood and guts and gore all over the place, but you just get that classic Corey Haim line, death by stereo.
Oh, yes.
It's so campy. Love it. Like, it's just so silly.
It's such a good way to describe it, is that it's a super violent Home Alone montage of, like, all the traps. All the gore is saved for this scene, but it's almost funny gore. I don't love gore for the sake of gore, but this was gore for comic effect, I think.
They've been describing this movie as a horror comedy, and that's absolutely what this final act is.
It's funny, and the fact that Grandpa at the end, like, busts through a wall with a bunch of stakes is very funny.
Oh. And they're, like, battling in this, like, horror house of taxidermy shit that he's put in there. Like, it just, it's such a weird setting.
Yeah.
So, all right, points for that, and then I need to do a gossipy thing here. This came up in our Hook episode where we were talking about the Julia Roberts and Kiefer Sutherland breakup. I need to get a little, like, reality television petty here and read from the Wikipedia page on Jason Patrick. Ready? Patrick began dating actress Julia Roberts days after she canceled her wedding to Patrick's The Lost Boys co-star and best friend Kiefer Sutherland in 1991.
Oh, no.
Patrick had been invited to the wedding, but was later uninvited by Sutherland.
Oh, no.
On June 14th, 1991, the day that was supposed to be Roberts and Sutherland's wedding, Sutherland moved out of Roberts' Hollywood Hills house, and Roberts traveled to Ireland with Jason Patrick. Then there's this whole thing about... there was this movie called The Renegades. I'm not reading literally here anymore, but there was this movie being made called The Renegades that Kiefer Sutherland and Julia Roberts were supposed to be in together. Kiefer dropped off it, so then Jason Patrick jumped onto it. He and Julia Roberts are going to be in it. Then she jumped off of it, so he also jumped off of it. And then Kiefer Sutherland picked it up again. And then he goes and he gets Jamie Gertz, who played Star from this movie, to be the romantic lead in that. So,
no,
like,
way.
This is such an incestual, movie making. But then the final bit here. So 10 years passes and Jason Patrick and Kiefer Sutherland have not been speaking at all ever since Jason kind of ran off with Julia Roberts on the day of Kiefer Sutherland's wedding.
So fucked up.
That they reconciled in the mid-2000s and co-starred in the Broadway revival of Jason Miller's play That Championship Season. And Jason Miller is Jason Patrick's dad. So they're like BFFs again, and neither of them married Julia Roberts.
That is a weird... That's crazy. Yeah, now listeners have to go back and listen to our Hook episode where we talk about how Julia Roberts behaved on
set.
Don't
watch it. Just look at it.
No, no, watch it because it's a great movie. Do not listen to Amanda, who did not have nostalgia for it. Very sad.
No, I didn't. I had nostalgia for it being bad, and it lived up to being bad.
Amanda's wrong on this one. And she was wrong on Overboard, but anyway.
And you were wrong on Mad Max. Anyway.
I might have been.
Let's move to ratings, but reminder that we are doing a Live Up After Dark episode, and so the ratings are slightly different.
Yeah, so at this point, so we're going to first rate it for adults. Does it live up to adults today? It's 1 being garbage, 10 being Princess Bride, and then we do the same rating for kids today, and we will have that consideration for kids, is that you have to kind of imagine somebody stumbling upon this when they kind of really shouldn't be watching an R-rated movie. So first rating that we're going to do, does it live up for adults? today. So I feel like you should go first because you're the one with nostalgia for it. Now, I might surprise you here.
Okay. So, yes, this is my birthday request. I'm going to give this a 7. Have nostalgia. I enjoyed watching it. It does feel very dated. It's like an 80s. You know what? It's my birthday. I'm giving this a 7.5 because...
7.5!
Because it's my birthday and I'm so happy I bought this on DVD for $6 off of Amazon.
You basically are giving yourself the 0.5 for the DVD, but
I'm giving myself a 0.5 because I'm enjoying owning this DVD.
The movie gets 7, Amanda gets a 0.5. So I also peeked at earlier ratings, which really makes me think that I personally underrated movies, even movies that I really loved. So adult, for me, I'm going to go lower, but I'm not going to go that low. So I went a 6 for adults. And now, okay. So that's pretty high for not having nostalgia for this movie. I know we've talked about Teen Wolf that we recently watched it. I feel like it's a little bit better than that. It's less dumb than Teen Wolf. Teen Wolf is kind of dumb. This is less dumb, but it's not as good as things like Edward Scissorhands and Addams Family or even True Beverly Hills. It's kind of a fun nostalgia watch, even if you haven't seen it before. And it's entertaining. It has a good sense of place. I'm kind of in. I'm not just like, oh my God, this is so cringe. It actually, the story moves. So I'm giving it a 6.
All right. I like this. Thank you.
All right. No problem. That's my birthday gift to you, is that 6 for adult ratings. That's a 13 and a half, if you will, doing some quick math, although Amanda's the order Muppet. She's in charge of the numbers. So the next rating, does it live up to kids today? Same scale, 1 being garbage, 10 being Princess Bride. We're going to imagine not necessarily kids today watching it, but it's kids today kind of stumbling upon it when they shouldn't, which is kind of a weird imagining.
I'm picturing my 13-year-old self seeing this movie in Mr. Yassi's class.
Mr. Yassi. If Mr. Yassi was teaching the class today and showed this movie,
I think
it's those kids.
Still show this and like wedge it in because he'd probably have to show one of the Twilight movies or something now. I'd rather watch this than Twilight, definitely.
Yeah. Honestly, kids today don't even know what Twilight is. That's sort of more solid millennial, not Gen Z.
Yeah.
Just throwing that
out
there.
So I think there's things in this movie that feel really dated, but at the same time, like, I do think it's got things that are relatable, like the peer pressure. So even though they're calling the restaurant with a landline. And again, this is for a 13-year-old watching a Mr. Yassi's class. I think I'm going to go a 7. So definitely not for young kids. But I think for a 13-year-old, this would be a 7.
So again, I'm going to go higher than you think here. Yes, about me.
Ooh.
I'm also going to go a 6 because I do think it's above average for somebody stumbling upon it. And I think you pointed this out. It is relatable that the teenage, I want to fit in and I'm getting sucked into this thing and I'm over my head. And I think that would still resonate. There are things that wouldn't resonate that might be dated, if you will, like the lack of female characters and all that stuff. But, you know, the basic tenets are there. I know I described this as like a mid-stakes vampire movie, but I think that
was a really good pun. Back up.
Wait, what was a good pun? What'd I say?
You said it was a
mid-stakes vampire movie. I didn't even realize it. Amazing. I'm so smart. So like, I do think the fact that it's not gory high stakes, that it's just about a couple of Corys eventually becoming vampires, that's actually, I think, a good thing. Like, a lot of stuff is heavy these days. It's like the weight of the world. And I think the fact that that's not here adds to the enjoyment. So I want to venture to say that kids might actually like it because it's not as heavy. I guess there's good-looking people in it. So I gave it a 6, which makes me think I really underrated other movies.
You have to be into guys to think there's good-looking
people. But,
like,
you know...
Star is cute. I think just let this be what it is. It is a campy horror comedy, and you can play this at midnight at a local theater, and people will love throwing things at the screen, and they will love whatever stripper you hired to play the sexy sax man.
Oh, my God, you gotta oil up that stripper first. That's pretty high for me for kid rating. Yeah. And I really wanted to hate this movie and I didn't.
Yay.
Wait, so what's our total now?
So we're at 26.5, which is on the line for us. And I'm going to make you go first because obviously you know where I'm going to land with this.
Right, so for listeners who are not familiar, we have to, so there's a final question after we rate with the numbers where we each decide for ourselves whether it lives up or not. We have to agree to have the podcast say that it lives up. And a lot of our split decisions are because somebody does not have nostalgia for this movie. Like Amanda was dead wrong about Hook and Overboard and True Beverly Hills, and she thinks I was wrong about Mad Max.
Willing to accept the Overboard, but the other two do not.
Oh, so wrong about Hook. I was like, I think this lives up. I think I have to say it lives up because it was hard to dislike this movie. It was hard to dislike it, even though I've never seen it before. And I was just like, fuck you, Amanda, and your birthday. I'm going to hate this movie. And I didn't hate it.
Yay. Oh, that's so good to hear. And I obviously think this lives up. I had so much fun rewatching it. I am so proud.
You own the DVD now.
I own the DVD now.
We have bucked the trend. We have had somebody who does not have nostalgia for this movie, and we have deemed it lived up. Congratulations, Lost Boys. Watch it on Halloween. It's fun. Show it to the kids.
If it's on TV, if your local theater is letting you throw things at it, yes, go see this.
Only if there's an oiled up sax player.
So. Thank you. That was the ultimate birthday gift, was hearing that you thought this was.
Oh, happy birthday, Amanda. So, you know, if I was too generous, please let me know at LiveUpPod on all the socials. I keep forgetting to do my social plug. What did we miss? Did we not talk about the hotness of Corey's enough? I think we did. Let us know.
I feel like we did with the chorus.
I feel like we did. Yeah. So hit us up on the social. Did you think it lives up or not? And wish Amanda a happy birthday.